Welcome back. It's a Friday, the 26th day of April, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and I guess any attempt to wrap up a week like this one has to begin chronologically with the Islamic attack on churches and upscale hotels in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday, of course. It's now killed, estimated, over 350 people and injured about 500 others. Seven suicide bombers and local organizations with international Islamic terror connections made it clear who was behind the blast, even if as a result of that, the waste stream quickly decided to change the subject. By Tuesday, the major news had become a mixture of the unbelievable and the downright obscene. For example, the war on scripture, along with the war on truth, continues and escalates. As some of the waste stream banner headlines make clear, for example, the WAPO is now trying to shift the narrative. They say, quote, Sri Lanka blasts were retaliation for New Zealand shooting, says official. Well, there you go. I guess those nasty Christians got what was coming to them, says the semi-official waste stream narrative. The UK's Daily Mail is pushing the same spiel, having evidently gotten the memo, while the New York Times says ISIS now claims responsibility for the bombings. But yes, they were payback for what happened in New Zealand. Just as disconcerting, they tell us that the feral bunglers of investigations from the U.S. have joined the so-called investigation. That'll fix it. But who knows? Maybe they'll find another reason to reopen the Mueller witch hunt against the President of the United States and blame him somehow. Deep down within the articles, they do admit that there were now not one, but two Islamist extremist groups that were probably involved, not just one, and seven different suicide bombers, while the official death count kept rising throughout the week. But as far as I know, we haven't seen any reports of elected officials in New Zealand wearing crosses in sympathy with these folks. And I'll make one more politically incorrect suggestion, given just how badly everything about the New Zealand Christchurch false flag seems to increasingly stink to high heaven. Is it really any kind of a surprise to anyone how the jihadis are now pointing to that event as an excuse for an escalation of violence that we all knew was coming anyway? After all, they did get the expected, massively politically correct response from the idiots in New Zealand. They got the gun control, they got the worldwide sympathy, and now they've managed to kill a whole bunch, many times more people, and it's only just beginning. Almost makes you wonder, says this particular cynic, if some of this wasn't exactly the plan all along. We'll follow that up with more from another front in what probably amounts to the same war, the southern U.S. border with Mexico. On Monday, Mexico warned about their deep concern that there were actually armed citizens in New Mexico trying to capture border invaders. How dare they? But at least Mexico could count on the FBI coming to their aid and arresting the leader of that group, if not the leaders of the hordes of invaders. But this next item is a story that's not getting nearly the attention that it deserves. This comes from Doug Hagman at thehagmanreport.com, as well as David Horowitz at the Conservative Review. By midweek, it got more attention because the president finally tweeted about it. And honestly, I'll tell you up front, it buries the lead. Here we go. On April 13th of 2019, didn't hear about this for over a week and a half, at approximately 2 p.m. Central Daylight Time, 5 to 6 Mexican military personnel questioned two U.S. Army soldiers, they were outnumbered, who were conducting border support operations in an unmarked Customs and Border Protection vehicle near the southwest border of the United States in the vicinity of Clint, Texas. Allow that to sink in and consider carefully what you just heard, said Hagman. The Mexican military crossed the border, entered the United States, and confronted the United States military. But wait, folks, there's more. Here's how Daniel Horowitz put it. The armed men swiftly approached U.S. service members crossing over from the Mexican side of the Rio Grande into U.S. territory and ordering the soldiers out of their vehicle, drum roll please, at gunpoint. Now let me get this straight. The communist criminal cartel-run Mexican government is oh so concerned about the fact that free people in the United States might be allowed to keep and bear arms. They don't allow that among their peons. But they're more than willing to send armed troops across the border and commit an act of war against U.S. military personnel. If this was another beta test, folks, to see how far the United States government can be pushed, the Trump regime just failed spectacularly. Either that or caved utterly to the deep state swamp. And their complicit deep state media doesn't even bother to report it. Daniel Horowitz, however, nails it. Quote, why is it that our government, I have to put sick after that for sure, because I don't think it's our government anymore. Anyway, why is it, he said, that our government, which appears unable or unwilling to deal with Mexican aggression, the cartels, or illegal immigration, is suddenly pursuing a zero-tolerance policy for American militias, seeking to do the job the federal government won't do? Failing to secure our borders is a breach of the social contract of government as laid out in the Declaration of Independence. Actually, folks, it's laid out right there in the Constitution, too, and it's not just a breach of the social contract. It's a breach of the rule of law and the very purpose for which that government was supposed to exist in the first place. Continues Horowitz, if there was anything that would ever justify the citizenry to take action, it's this issue. Well, there's more coming. We'll get to that in a second. It's not something, he said, we want to see, but where is our own government in dealing with the problem? From there, we go to this story, and how many of these are we going to have to see before people wake up and realize that the WAPO, CNN, MSNBC, and most of the waste stream, including most of the criminal traitors in Congress, have been lying through their teeth for a long time now? Officials in Las Cruces, New Mexico, says a piece from Bob Price at Breitbart, reported on Monday that Border Patrol agents released nearly 1,600 migrants into their community over just a 10-day period. And the city, which doesn't have the money, was forced to spend about $75,000 for so-called humanitarian assistance. And in case you're curious, the population of Las Cruces is right about 100,000, meaning they got more than 1.5% of their entire population dumped on them right across the border in about a third of a month. Border Patrol officials said the story began releasing migrants apprehended in the El Paso sector on April the 12th, according to the El Paso ABC affiliate. And these releases come as the sector reached the breaking point, with thousands of Central American migrant families crossing the border illegally in West Texas and the New Mexico boot heel. Just recently, the city of Las Cruces responded by setting up a network of temporary shelters to house the so-called asylum seekers while they attempt to arrange travel to scatter them all over the rest of the United States. And nearly 1,200 were dropped off by Border Patrol agents during the first week of the invasion alone. Mayor Ken Miyagashami told the local newspaper that most of the migrants, quote, move out quickly. 75% are gone, he said. And get this, folks. The mayor has made arrangements with the cities of Santa Fe and Albuquerque further north to take the migrants on a rotating basis. Looks like they'll be taking some, he said. We just need to figure out transportation. Yeah, we could easily handle a couple hundred, but not 200 a day, the mayor explained. That's why I'm thinking if Santa Fe can do a couple of hundred every 3 days, I think that's more manageable. And does anybody else see just a little bit of a problem here? Why am I suddenly hearkening back to old movies with titles like Escape from Los Angeles and Escape from New York? The trouble is, those liberal sanctuary city hellholes don't yet have walls around them to keep the invaders in. And about the only thing we know for sure about them, other than that many are carrying disease, is that they've demonstrated they do not respect borders, laws, and property rights. Officials from the New Mexico Department of Homeland Security, SIC, told the El Paso TV station they expect more asylum seekers to continue to be dropped off in Las Cruces, well, for at least several more weeks. And in the meantime, county officials in neighboring Otero County declared a state of emergency, unanimously, and called on the traitorous New Mexico governor to redeploy the National Guard that she ordered out of the area so that Border Patrol agents can reopen interior checkpoints, according to the El Paso Times. Quote, if this demand is not met by the state of New Mexico in 1 week's time, the county of Otero will take action itself to provide security and safety and well-being for the people in this county, said the county commission chairman Coy Griffin in a statement. Otero County will also consider litigation in regards to the state of New Mexico failing to follow its constitutional duties towards the people of Otero County. By midweek, as I mentioned, President Trump did join the fray, as several sources, including the UK's Daily Mail and Russia's Sputnik News, highlighted Trump's warnings to Mexico against what he referred to as pulling guns on U.S. troops, and as a result, he sent forces to the border. Here's his tweet from bright and early Wednesday morning. Mexico's soldiers, the president wrote, recently pulled guns on our National Guard soldiers, probably as a diversionary tactic for drug smugglers on the border. Better not happen again. We are now sending armed, and he puts it all in caps, soldiers to the border. Mexico is not doing nearly enough in apprehending and returning, unquote. And that comment, of course, came hot on the heels of the report earlier that two U.S. soldiers had been questioned at gunpoint, by the way, by Mexican troops back on the 13th of April on U.S. territory by Mexican military who weren't. The Daily Mail reported that officials said the Mexicans, although they were not wearing insignia to identify themselves as members of the military, were armed with rifles and raised their weapons when they saw the U.S. soldiers, before forcing them out of their car and taking a Beretta pistol from one of them. This story says that Trump mistakenly identified the American soldiers involved in the incident as National Guardsmen, when they were in fact Army Field Artillery Battalion regulars dispatched from Joint Base Lewis-McChord in the state of Washington, according to a Pentagon source who acknowledged this was an unprecedented encounter. They also quoted the Washington Examiner, noting that an official on Tuesday said the American military personnel followed the right protocol in allowing themselves, at least this time, to be disarmed in order to prevent a firefight or other needless escalation. It also sounds, folks, like they were outmanned and outgunned, which probably had a lot to do with it as well. Newswars.com has yet another of the many videos up showing, quote, heavily armed men escorting illegal migrants across the U.S. southern border that was shared by, this time, Customs and Border Protection. At least 5 men, it says, appearing to be wearing tactical gear and toting rifles, can be observed bringing a Guatemalan woman and her child to a border fence near Lukeville, Arizona, under cover of darkness. One of the men can be seen crossing the border with the 2 migrants, walking a short distance with them before rejoining his comrades. And this, says the Border Patrol, was an area commonly used by smugglers to bring large groups of Central Americans into the country illegally. The CBP said this activity is highly concerning to them and noted that the incident represents how criminal organizations are behind the lucrative surge of Central American immigrants. Guatemalans, it says, are paying roughly $7,000 to smugglers to transport them from their home to the U.S. border. Said Fox News, these armed individuals along the border represent an escalation of tactics. This is not mom and dad and kids deciding to head to the border. This is a no-kidding orchestrated effort to bring individuals to the U.S. It's not just the numbers, it's who is running this enterprise, unquote. And isn't that a phrase that's pregnant with meaning? Concluded the Daily Mail piece, the Trump administration has put toughened pressure on Mexico in an attempt to discourage people from attempting to cross into the United States illegally. His tweet indicated another major caravan of about 20,000 was trying to make its way north to the U.S., and he said, quote, Mexico must apprehend the remainder or we will be forced to close that section of the border and call up the military. The coyotes and cartels have weapons, he wrote. And let me say this, folks. It would be not only naive but suicidal to believe that there aren't state actors and other forces completely antithetical to the United States who are taking every possible advantage of this situation, a lot more so than the traitors in Congress and the U.S. press would like you to understand. New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham isn't the only outright traitor sitting in a governor's mansion, though. In New Jersey, the traitorous slimebag Governor Phil Murphy wants to significantly increase the cost of owning a gun in the state, proposing fees that even the New York Times admits would be among the highest in the country to do what was once called a God-given right protected by a constitution these people now not only detest, but actively seek to undermine. Traitors from without and traitors from within. Guess which is more dangerous? The new fee, says a summary piece from Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge, would, as they always do, disproportionately punish low-income, law-abiding, mostly minority gun owners, but the left doesn't care about that, who wish to defend themselves and their families in increasingly, and no surprise here, high-crime areas. And by the time these traitors have completely disarmed them, they'll be far higher crime areas still. The idiot oathbreaker claims there is, quote, no war on responsible gun owners, unquote. No, it's a war on all gun owners, folks. But that the funds raised from the fee hike would simply go towards anti-violence initiatives, basically echoing Einstein's famous definition of insanity.
And as if to emphasize that, the traitorous governor said this, quote, I was in Jersey City. It's at least $10 to get a dog license in Jersey City, but it's still $2 to get a permit to purchase a firearm in New Jersey, unquote. Well, gee, you blankety-blankin' liar, which one is protected by the Constitution as a God-given right? And furthermore, since when do peons who aren't actually slaves have to get a permit from you to have a dog or a gun? And that, folks, is the element of this article that I really wanted to emphasize for a minute. The very concept, back when we had a rule of law of shall not be infringed, meant there's no way that you have to have a permit to exercise a God-given right to begin with. But once you've allowed that fundamental principle to be violated, what follows is obvious. Currently, says the story, a firearm ID costs $5. A permit for a slave to own a gun is $2, and a permit to carry a gun costs just, what do you mean, just, $20. The slave master wants to raise that to $100 for the ID, Achtung, $50 just to be allowed as a slave to have a gun. You don't really own it if you have to have a permit, of course, and $400 if you thought you might be able to first keep and then carry it. In addition, Murphy wants to slap another 10% excise tax on ammunition and a 2.5% firearms excise tax. So in other words, he wants to raise the slave fees to do that which free people once did anyway by a factor of 20. And how many more times will they have to do that before first the low income and then the middle class are priced out of the ability to defend themselves from what they intend to do completely? I guess pretty soon the only people allowed to carry guns will be invaders from Mexico. Let me say it again. Slaves don't have rights. And once you allow that Big Brother has a claim to require a permit before you can do something that once free people did without it, it's just a matter of time until they decide, we'll raise the fee so high that the slaves get the idea, figure out who's boss, and give up trying. Next, because it fits, we have a couple of candidates for not only Whopper of the Week, but at least one that might fit the category of Whopper of the Year. And that means you already know the source. The still unindicted Hillary Clinton, who outdid even her own legendary hypocrisy this time. And no, folks, I'm not going to try to play the recording. It's bad enough just having to read this. So let's start with the summaries. On Tuesday, after Nancy Pelosi had a brief bout with sanity and backed off from the idea of impeachment without grounds, failed presidential candidate and mob boss Hillary Clinton decided to pile onto the impeachment harangue with her own take on the Mueller witch hunt report. Quote, well, I think what Nancy means, and I agree with what she means, is that it shouldn't be a preordained conclusion. Listen to this, folks. It gets better. It shouldn't be what you do for partisan political purposes.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Almost outside the framework of the Constitution, unquote. She said during an appearance at the Time 100 Summit in New York. Where else? Quote, you don't put impeachment on the table as the only item on the table and say you're going to get there no matter what. Which is what she says happened in 99. Instead, you say we're going to proceed with the seriousness that this demands, unquote. Well, if they proceeded with any seriousness, folks, lock her up would have happened a long time ago. As Tyler Durden says, dripping with irony, Hillary, whose criminal husband was impeached by the House of Representatives in 1998 for perjury, obviously, and obstruction of justice, but not, of course, for the myriad of other high crimes and misdemeanors we've learned he committed since, after which a sellout Senate dropped the ball anyway, as intended, and Hillary allegedly, it says, used her position to gain lots and lots of personal wealth through her well-known pay-to-play peddling of her and her husband's influence, discussed the roadmap, as she sees it, to the inevitable impeachment of President Trump, and says he should have been indicted. Quote, I have kind of a weird personal history about impeachment, said Clinton to laughter from the leftist audience. But not what you're thinking, she added, referring instead to her time learning the ropes as a staff attorney working on the impeachment inquiry for former President Tricky Dick Nixon 2 decades earlier in 1974. Quote, I was one of the young lawyers who actually drafted the memo about what is a high crime and misdemeanor. Now, ponder the irony of that for a second, folks, because later she used what she learned there to elevate high crimes and misdemeanors to high art. And here comes the real hypocrisy. She says, quote, it was truly meant by our founders to describe actions that undermine the integrity of our government, that place the personal or political interest in a president over the interest of the nation, unquote. And yeah, she actually said that.
The founders, of course, were talking about the then constitutional form of government, as opposed to what's replaced it. The whoppers, though, just kept on coming. Quote,
so I know what it looks like. Oh, you betcha she does. That part at least is true. And I know what is required to do it, meaning treason, I think, in a way that wins the trust and confidence not only of Congress, but of the American people.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
And you know, I had to do that. But, she continued, doubling down, I certainly think that the roadmap, as some call it, of the Mueller report raises so many serious questions in part one about what the Russians did, which is beyond debate. Well, yeah, they got what she was paid for, and she got what she paid for through Fusion GPS. I guess it's a win-win for Team Treason. Back to the disgusting quote. And in part two, about all the evidence about obstruction. Let me try to make this as simple as I can. The fact that the Mueller report even exists is more obstruction evidence than anything a whole long list of now dead witnesses will ever be able to testify to. And you know what? I don't think the word bleach bit even appears in that entire 400 pages plus. Yes, said the world's most infamous unindicted traitor, the Mueller report is just part of the beginning. But are you ready for the coup de grace? This is how Time put it in their summary tweet, quote, I think there's enough there that any other person who engaged in those acts would certainly have been indicted.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. Well, I ain't got a witness and I can't prove it, but that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Unquote. Well, creepy Uncle Joe Biden is not nearly as good of a liar, but he didn't want to be left out, and I wouldn't have even done this story but for the context. Following months of anticipatory leaks, as the summary from Zero Hedge, and of course the groping scandal, Gropegate they call it, that nearly derailed the former VP's ambitions, creepy Joe Biden, who consistently polls near the top of a disgusting field of socialist Democrats, and there, folks, is your lesser of multiple evils, has now announced his plans to seek the 2020 nomination. And here's the reason why I did it, folks. Declaring that he's decided to run because, quote, the core values of this nation, our standing in the world, our very democracy, everything that's made America, America, is at stake, unquote. And obviously, he's too late. A, our core values have pretty well been destroyed by the likes of creepy Joe Biden. And B, anybody who's that incredibly ignorant of what form of government we were once supposed to have has no business claiming that what made America, America is at stake. He's an idiot or a liar, and arguably both. Although an honest jury would definitely have to lean toward the latter. But he almost deserves to be the Democrat frontrunner. He does have a couple of problems, though. He's a white male, and it would almost be the epitome of hypocrisy for them to nominate that guy to run, given their no longer hidden bigotry towards such. And, of course, when it comes to Me Too, his reputation suggests he's pretty well at the top of the groping heap. Right, Creepy Joe? But that, at least, puts him smack in the mainstream of the leftist sexual hypocrites. So at least when it comes to hypocrisy, you do have to admit, creepy Uncle Joe's your man. Which leads me to suggest something, folks. Our form of government was supposed to be a republic, and if you remember the quote from Benjamin Franklin outside the Constitutional Convention, when he was asked, what form of government have you given us, Dr. Franklin? He replied, a republic, madam, if you can keep it, unquote. And obviously he was right, and we haven't. In no small part because most Americans have now been dumbed down to the point where they don't even know what a republic is, and why the founders called democracy the devil's own government, or mobocracy, and put so many different constitutional protections in place to prevent it, many of which are now either subverted or ignored outright. And we'll pick it up there right after this bottom of the hour break.
I ain't free, change is all around. Get a mind.
are back, and this is Mark Call. And as we went to break, I was talking a little bit about what's become of the true rule of law in America and the concept of a constitutional republic. Obviously, it hasn't been taught in the public cesspools for a long time, to the point where traitors like creepy Joe Biden are able to say our democracy is at risk because they're petrified that somebody might actually pull out a copy of the Constitution and read it. Which leads me to the question, what do we have instead? No, it clearly isn't a democracy. The founders made darn sure that when we had a constitution, the idea was to erect every impediment they could think of to prevent that evil thing from coming about. From a bicameral house, to all kinds of supermajorities for various things, to a tripartite government sharing separate powers in a system of what's been called checks and balances. And while the idiot occasional cortex doesn't know what that means, perhaps because it comes right out of Isaiah chapter 33, where the creator of the universe and the author of that book that's at least no longer allowed on the floor of the house said, I'm your king, I'm your judge, I'm your lawgiver. And James Madison later famously remarked that the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, whether one, a few, or many, and regardless of how they got there, may, quote, justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. And when it came to the combination of those three powers, only God himself could be trusted with them. In his hands only, said the founders, could they be combined. So thus, a republic with separation of powers. But over the years, all kinds of executive branch unconstitutional agencies, with the power to be judge, jury, and executioner, and write their own laws, from the IRS to the EPA to the FDA, and of course the utterly unconstitutional BATF, have made a literal mockery of that concept. Certainly over the years, people have suggested that what we have instead now is an oligarchy, ruled by a few super-rich people who have the ability to do things like, you know, print money and be above the law. That one's tough to argue with. Same thing goes for a technocracy. Whether that means rule by HAL from 2001 A Space Odyssey, or the Terminator's Skynet, a bunch of self-appointed bureaucrats that think they know better than you how to run your lives because it's all scientific, you know? Or even the gulag Facebook, YouTube, Amazon, Twitter, public-private techno-mind. In any case, I'm going to argue, based on what we've just been talking about, as well as most of the rest of the news this week, that what we really have is not yet, thankfully, a democracy. It's certainly no longer a republic, not a technocracy or even an oligarchy, but in fact, a hypocrisy, that's spelled H-Y-P-O-C-R-A-C-Y, where if you can imagine somebody saying something and doing the opposite, well, they're fit to rule. And ultimately, the technocracy aspect won't even allow others, those who don't buy into the lie, to speak, much less defend themselves from what's intended for them. Case in point. Actually, I guess there are a couple today. We'll start with a prominent conservative YouTuber. Yeah, I know. Named Steven Crowder, who has a series up dealing with, among other things, Build the Wall, Change My Mind. But this week, he said he'd been demonetized, join the crowd, by the public-private platform. In a series of tweets, Crowder said, in order to be able to continue making a living and employing 15 people, I've decided, as a result of his latest encounter with the socialists running that entity, to identify as a trans queer intersectional code specialist. Hey, YouTube, is this acceptable? Please advise. The point, he continued, is this. If YouTube demonetizes the Change My Mind series on the basis of it being a violation of guidelines, then there is no world in which conservatives are welcome. And he followed that up with what he called a genuine question. If YouTube considers Change My Mind to be a violation of their so-called guidelines, how then can conservatives even create content which is not a violation of their guidelines? I want to know, and I think the rest of us already do. Because that's the plan. And let's be clear here. That doesn't mean you can't create it, folks, at least not yet. It just means that Big Brother's partners aren't going to allow you to profit by it. No, evil profits are only for the socialists. Related story. Michael Savage seems to have been shadow banned. I guess we'd have to say again. By Twitter, which has evidently been working hard to elevate the process to an art, and he's being very vocal about it. From Steve Watson at Prison Planet, and having seen it firsthand for quite a while, you'd think they would qualify as experts on the process. It all happened this time because Savage believes that Islamic terrorists may have been behind the Notre Dame blaze, and he's been vocal about it. Well, at least he tried. His reasoning, of course, is pretty clear. Terrorists attempted to set the cathedral on fire as recently as 2016, in addition to the fact, whether it's being reported widely or not, that hundreds of churches in France have been desecrated and, yes, burned in France over the past year. Here's one of his now verboten tweets. Why do I say terrorists set Notre Dame ablaze? In 2016, three radical Islamists were caught in front of the cathedral with gas canisters in their car, arrested, tried, and sentenced just last week. Is the investigation of possible arson or terror to be over while the ashes are still smoldering? Lies and cover-up, he said. Use common sense. This was terrorism. Trouble is, he found out that not many people were going to be allowed to see it. Once he expressed his opinion, Twitter stopped other users from seeing his posts. I guess you could say, Achtung, there is an official narrative. How do you say that in occupied French? And this isn't it, wrote one of his employees, Amanda Metzger, quote, it became apparent Sunday after being temporarily blocked last week following the burning of Notre Dame that he may now join the rebels in the shadows. Some of his followers, she explained, who used to receive notifications of his tweets on their smartphones, are no longer getting them. She also noted that Savage, quote, suddenly found his Periscope live broadcast was limited in the number of viewers. Oh, and guess who owns Periscope? Extra points if you said public-private partner, Twitter. And continues the piece from an InfoWars employee. That site, owned by Alex Jones, is still permanently banned from Twitter. And, of course, in this case, no explanation was ever given other than the vague suggestion that Jones somehow violated their terms and conditions. And it's still one more bit of related news, concludes the piece. It appears Twitter is now planning to allow, maybe even encourage, users to report tweets that they believe are an attempt to mislead people at election time. In other words, get them to vote for somebody other than the designated socialist. What could possibly go wrong? Well, here's a hint. In a blog post regarding this latest totalitarian move, Twitter declared, and try to keep your chortling under control, quote, any attempts to undermine the process of registering to vote or engaging in the electoral process is contrary to our company's core values. And hey, doesn't that lend new meaning to the term rotten to the core? Which brings me to this piece via a number of Waystream sources. President Trump sat down for a meeting with the CEO of that public-private partner, Twitter. We're talking about Jack Dorsey on Tuesday, just hours after he accused the company, say the stories, of playing political games and messing with his follower count, a.k.a. more shadow banning. Trump welcomed Dorsey to the Oval Office, shared a positive message and photo of the chat on Twitter, saying, great meeting this afternoon at the White House with Jack from Twitter. Lots of subject discussed regarding their platform and the world of social media in general, wrote the man who arguably they don't want to be president in spite of the high-profile attention he's brought them. Looking forward, he said, to keeping an open dialogue. The WAPO, though, reported that Trump's meeting with Dorsey focused mainly on his gripe that Twitter had, quote, quietly and deliberately removed some of his followers. And he also reportedly told Dorsey he'd heard similar complaints from fellow conservatives. Yeah, folks, lots and lots and lots of them, hopefully, because there certainly are lots who've seen it. Which brings me to, well, let's just say some alternative spin from the other elements of the Ministries of Truth. Like this headline from Completely Negligent News and their business department. I wonder if the Soviets had a Pravda business section. Anyway, it says, President Trump met with Chief Executive Jack Dorsey on Tuesday, hours after Trump erroneously accused the social media company of discriminatory, and they put it in quotes, behavior toward conservative users. Nice of them to put that word erroneously in there, in spite of the facts, isn't it? And here's how the Never Believe Communist News tried to propagandize the same story in there, not that different way. Yeah, it begins, Trump met with Twitter CEO Dorsey on Tuesday just hours after claiming the company had treated him poorly. And then they go on to say this, Trump has been both a prolific user of Twitter and a vocal critic, suggesting at times, and without evidence, good grief, that Silicon Valley's socialist, I put that in there, media giants have a bias against conservatives. I've already led up with stories just today that prove how bald-faced of a lie that is. And the only way you could actually ascertain whether that's true or not is by looking at the facts, which obviously none of the public-private partners want to allow you to do. Now here, folks, I insert just a very quick story to emphasize that point. The company I refer to as Two Facebook announced earlier this week that Jennifer Newstead, a Trump appointee who worked in George Bush's Just Us department, will join the socialist media platform as general counsel, supervising its globalist legal function. Let me cut to the chase here. Says Zero Hedge, among others, Newstead brings a terrifying history along with her, from lobbying and legislating for an Orwellian-style mass electronic surveillance of Americans to the fact that she authored the anti-constitutional, grossly misnamed Patriot Act. So when it comes to undermining privacy, it's hard to argue Facebook didn't just telegraph their next moves. For his part, and at least the socialists do report on this, Trump wrote that Twitter was very discriminatory and claimed that the platform made it harder for people to sign on. And in a subsequent tweet, Trump claimed his follower count would be higher if Twitter weren't, quote, playing their political games, adding, and listen to this, folks, no wonder Congress wants to get involved, and they should, unquote. Well, let me tell you instead what all kinds of Twitter users, including the current, the former, and for some of us, the never, have been suggesting for quite a while. Why doesn't the president make a high-profile exit from the socialist platform and pick one of the much smaller, not nearly so subsidized, but certainly in need of his help, alternative platforms that don't do the Big Brother-style censorship? No doubt almost all of his followers, including a whole bunch that have probably been shadow banned and didn't even know it, would follow him. That even goes for the leftist press that basically would still want to find out what he's saying, even if they don't like the non-socialist platform. And overnight, he'd literally put an alternative to Big Brother's bird calls right there on the map. Talk about a bully pulpit. And the fact that he hasn't, folks, when it's so painfully obvious at this point, almost strikes me as a sellout. He doesn't need an act of the do-nothing Congress to do that. So yeah, what the heck is he waiting for? From there we go next to this. More lies from the highest levels, and more whistleblowing from those who really know. This comes from Mark F. McCarty via Medium.com, and it has to do with the mysterious death of one Seth Rich, the imprisonment of Julian Assange, and the lies that have linked all of that with the overhyped scapegoat of Russian hacking, and of course, the infamous Mueller witch hunt report. It starts by noting that an attorney named Ty Clevenger issued a FOIA request a long time ago regarding the late Seth Rich. He received a response saying the request had been processed under the FOIA provisions, and 15 documents of 32 pages responsive to this request have been reviewed by the agency as required by FOIA, but they're classified top secret and secret, so you can't have them. Prompting McCarty to write that although I was somewhat confused by the initial meaning of this revelation, it does bear comment because at the very least it meant that the view that Seth Rich was the source of the WikiLeaks DNC releases was more than the brainless and callous conspiracy theory that the waste stream media were trying to make it out to be. In other words, you have to ask the obvious question. Just why does the NSA have 32 pages of secret and top secret documents on the late Seth Rich? But fortunately, one of the highest executives ever to turn a whistleblower, and one of the smartest men, as he puts it, ever to work for the U.S. government, William Binney, has offered clarification on all of this in a brief interview with Ed Butowski that he gave just last week, in which he offers a devastating rebuke of the fraudulent Mueller report's analysis of so-called Russian hacking. But the truly fascinating part occurs well into the interview, where Binney discusses Clevenger's FOIA request and says, quote, Ty Clevenger has FOIA'd information from NSA asking for any data that involved both Seth Rich and also Julian Assange. And they responded by saying, we've got 15 files, 32 pages, but they're all classified in accordance with Executive Order 13526 covering classification, and therefore you can't have them. That means the NSA has records of communications between Seth Rich and Julian Assange. And continues Binney, I mean, that's the only business NSA is in, copying communications between people and devices. And if you're curious, folks, Executive Order 13526 is, of course, from the Obama regime, dated December 29th, 2009. One of a series of such outlining how that guy wanted classified information to be handled. No surprise. So basically, what the man once called the father of the NSA is saying provides strong support for the hypothesis that Seth Rich was indeed the source for WikiLeaks of the DNC emails it published. Assange, it says, has strongly hinted at this. Cy Hirsch claims to have a trusted informant inside the FBI who states he has seen FBI documents verifying it. And Binney himself says he has not one but two sources inside the intelligence community vouching for this. And Bill Binney has long offered technical evidence suggesting that the Russian fingerprints and the metadata and the whole Russia hacked the DNC from afar story is utter BS. Timestamps on the data prove that it couldn't have been remotely hacked via a slower overseas internet connection, had to have been taken off of a much higher speed thumb drive inserted directly into the servers in question, like at DNC headquarters by somebody with access there. As Binney himself makes clear, the Mueller report's tale of how WikiLeaks allegedly received the DNC emails from GRU agents styling themselves as Guccifer 2.0 is absurd on its face to reasonable people who will examine the pertinent evidence. Far from being a Russian hacker masquerading as a Romanian, the story continues, G2.0 has operated in U.S. time zones, downloaded some of his hacks via thumb drive, purposely implanted Russian fingerprints in a kind of an amateur way besides in the metadata of his own releases, impersonating a Russian using intermittently broken English, and furthermore, never himself published any documents denigratory to the Clinton campaign. The GRU, if they really did hack the DNC, would have had no need for such a ridiculous figure. But G2.0 functions wonderfully as a vehicle for incriminating Russia as the source of the emails published by WikiLeaks, tarring Assange and Russia with the same brush. Almost, folks, like it was a softball being pitched directly to Bob Mueller's team. And furthermore, says the story, if you examine Mueller's report carefully, you'll note that he never actually states, much less demonstrates, that the material which Guccifer 2.0 passed along to WikiLeaks consisted of the DNC emails which WikiLeaks published, undoubtedly because Mueller has no evidence for this. And indeed, there are a number of technical details which don't match up either. The cyber analytic findings pointing to Guccifer 2.0 being a fraud masquerading as a Russian hacker are, in fact, touched on in Binney's interview and comprehensively discussed in the website of Adam Carter devoted to the issue. But here's the big question. How does Mueller's so-called report deal with all of this countervailing evidence? Does he offer credible rebuttals to each of the findings? No. With consummate dishonesty, he simply ignores all of the evidence in toto. And he feels no compunction to address that evidence because, with rare exceptions, the way stream media has done such a good job covering things up that most Americans are wholly unaware of the whole issue. Mueller's report on so-called Russian meddling, says McCarty, is simply intended to reinforce the deep state's preferred narrative, which he achieves by cherry-picking the evidence that he deigns to consider. And that was the precise strategy that the deep state, including Mueller himself, employed when they sold the nation out previously on Saddam's alleged WMDs. And here's another intriguing point. CrowdStrike's co-founder, Sean Henry, used to be Mueller's deputy at the FBI, acting head of the counterintelligence division. And Adam Carter, says the author, informs me that while Henry headed that division, it made an attempt to destroy WikiLeaks' reputation by feeding it bogus documents that had been purposely altered. Fortunately, WikiLeaks exercised its customary caution and refused to take the bait. So Guccifer 2.0, very likely also a creation of CrowdStrike, appears to have been yet another attempt to smear WikiLeaks. But this one's worked wonderfully well with much of the gullible American public. Hillary Clinton's incompetence was expiated, WikiLeaks was smeared, and Russia was further defamed, all in one stroke. As he puts it, it's a deep state wet dream. Assange became not a journalist, working with an American whistleblower disgusted by the gross bias of the DNC against Bernie, but instead a tool of malign Russians intent on meddling in our so-called democracy and saddling us with the ridiculous Trump. And as to Seth Rich's mysterious death, well, ask yourself this. Who would have been in a perfect position to destroy the Russia, Russia, Russia hacking narrative that Clinton's campaign and CrowdStrike had decided to run with? Answer: Dead men tell no tales. Finally today, I want to take a look at something that Dave Hodges of the Common Sense Show did concerning what he calls the cartel takeover of local American communities. And it reflects the changing political and law enforcement sick landscape of the new America. The problem, he says, is that the drug cartels coming north out of Mexico are following an established Agenda 21, or UN model, based on local control of the political process, resulting in dramatic bottom-up control. Agenda 21 has now become Agenda 2030, and it focuses on replacing local law enforcement agencies in favor of new, friendly, and on-the-payroll personnel. And also, he says, we're seeing more and more obscure individuals brought in from other communities in order to assume positions of leadership in the local political and law enforcement community. He refers first to his story about the takeover of Humboldt County, California, by the cartels, and says, since then, many first-hand accounts have come my way, and we've discovered similar things happening in communities across America, from Ohio to Florida to New Mexico to California. And there's compelling and increasing evidence of cartel control of many local communities. And here's just one example from a writer in New Mexico that he says represents more than a dozen like it he's seen. Every little village in the area, he says, has a cartel rep in residence. And the locals tell me they all know who the person is. That individual keeps an eye on what's going on in the village and the attitude towards the cartel and notes any talkers. No one dares to say a word against the cartel, and anyone who gets crosswise with them tends to disappear. See, you thought it was just in Mexico, but that was back when we had a border. Since the cartel moved into the county, the email continues, most of the longtime deputies at the sheriff's office have left and been replaced by new guys. Some of them are married to women from the cartel families, and it's pretty much assumed the sheriff's office is compromised, and the residents basically know better than to bother to report problems. He does say that at least in New Mexico, everyone is routinely armed for self-defense, although, quote, concealed carry requires a permit. Open carry is totally lawful, so it's not uncommon in most rural areas to see people with sidearms, and it's a good bet any pickup contains a loaded weapon within the driver's reach. As a matter of fact, a New Mexico state police officer was adamant with me, the author writes, that I'd better be carrying my gun on my person anytime I went outside my house, even in my own horse pasture. That militia, he noted, may be getting, quote, reamed in the media, but these guys are plenty brave to be there at all, let alone facing hundreds of border crossers at a time of unknown character. Those patriots wear camo and ghillie suits for a reason. They're not just playing army. Hodges describes other emails, like one from a deputy in the same state, who says he has to be careful at work, learning not to open up with any deputy he hadn't previously known. And he, too, notes more and more people moving into the community and assuming leadership positions, despite the fact that, quote, nobody at the local level knows who the hell these people are. He also noted he no longer has access to the evidence lockers, where seized drug evidence is kept, but somehow on the way to court, the evidence mysteriously disappears. Writes Hodges, in summary of at least this first part, for decades the communist Chinese controlled much of the drug trafficking in Central and South America, but to maintain respectability, they began to employ local gangsters in the area to control drug, gun, and child trafficking. As a DEA agent, he said, told me nearly 5 years ago, the Chinese found it more efficient to set up an Air America-type operation, and in doing so, they were able to expand their reach by using local thugs. The drug cartel wars in places like Mexico is an outgrowth of the fighting for local control by the various cartels. However, it's the Chinese that are sitting at the head of the table and letting nature take its course. And as trafficking of all kinds begins to move north and make its way in the United States, the Chinese, even though they employ groups like the Sinaloa cartel, are able to maintain plausible deniability. And if you want to understand how this works, look no further than California, now pretty much communist, and the CalExit movement there, designed to remove California completely from the United States and place it, at least allegedly, as a protectorate under the United Nations, but really as a Chinese satellite state, right there on the left coast of formerly free America. You look at the cast of crooked characters in California and their Chinese connections, and all the pieces begin to fall into place. America is under attack from within and without, and if we wait for Washington to fix it, or even the press to report it, it's already way too late.